I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
We're here today because it's out of the question to once again raise the retirement age. It's time for them to understand that people also want to enjoy their lives. We're not here to die on the job. We're here to be able to enjoy life one day, too.
As many as 3 million people take to the streets of France as anger mounts over President Macron's move to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64. We'll go to Marseille for the latest. We'll also talk to Congressmember Ro Khanna about the banking crisis, TikTok, and more. Then investigative journalist James Bamford reveals how Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu clandestinely tried to help Donald Trump get elected in 2016.
There was no collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign, as the Mueller report concluded. But what was totally missed was the collusion, very extensive collusion, between the Prime Minister of Israel and the Trump campaign.
And we'll get an update from Atlanta on the protest against Cop City, those charged with domestic terrorism. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel passed a law Thursday to shield Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu from removal as he faces a corruption trial and massive protests against anti-democratic reforms to disempower Israel's judiciary. Scores of protesters were arrested Thursday during a more massive nationwide protest designed to bring Israel to a standstill, while Israel's attorney general said in a letter earlier today the plan to gut the justice system is illegal. Netanyahu is meeting with Prime Minister Rishi Sunak in the U.K. today. As he arrived at 10 Downing Street, Netanyahu was greeted by a protester, jeers and calls of shame and traitor. Meanwhile, another Palestinian was killed Thursday as Ramadan was starting by Israeli forces during a raid in the occupied West Bank. 25-year-old Amir Abu Khadija is at least the 85th Palestinian to be killed by Israeli forces in 2023, or Israeli settlers. In France, an estimated 3.5 million people took to the streets Thursday in a nationwide general strike to protest President Emmanuel Macron's deeply unpopular move to raise the age of retirement from 62 to 64. His government forced the legislation through the National Assembly using a constitutional clause to bypass a parliamentary vote. This is a protester in Nice.
I'm on strike to protest against the pension reform, but mainly also against what is happening in the government with the denial of democracy, which is quite significant right now. They are not listening to the people anymore, and it's important to us to be here so our voice can be heard and to say what is happening is not normal. If the people are against a reform, they should be heard.
After headlines, we'll go to France for the latest. The United States and Canada have reached an agreement to block migrants from seeking asylum if they're apprehended attempting to cross the U.S. northern border into Canada. President Joe Biden, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau are expected to announce the deal in Ottawa today during Biden's first official trip to Canada since taking office. Canada's also reportedly agreed to allow up to 15,000 Central American migrants into the country over the next year. Tens of thousands of migrants have been making their way to Canada as the U.S. enforces harsh immigration policies. Advocates denounce the move as Biden's latest attempt to discourage people from even attempting to trek north for refuge. Biden and Trudeau are also expected to discuss the worsening gang violence and humanitarian crisis in Haiti, as the U.S. has been pushing the Canadian government to lead a multinational armed intervention of Haiti. The Pentagon says it's carried out multiple airstrikes inside Syria. This, according to U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, who said the overnight attacks were in response to a drone attack by Iran-backed fighters that killed a U.S. military contractor, wounded another, and wounded five U.S. troops as well. The U.K.-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said the U.S. airstrikes killed 11 Iranian-backed fighters in three locations, though those reports could not be confirmed. Congress has not formally authorized U.S. military action in Syria, though last year a majority of both Republicans and Democrats in the House voted down a resolution to withdraw all remaining U.S. troops from Syria. The U.S. strikes came after Israeli warplanes bombed the international airport in the northern Syrian city of Aleppo Wednesday, damaging equipment and bringing flights to a halt. It was Israel's second attack on Aleppo's main airport this month. In other news from Syria, reports emerged Thursday that Saudi Arabia and Syria are nearing a deal in Russian-brokered talks to restore diplomatic ties that were cut off in 2012 as Saudi Arabia backed Syrian rebel fighters in the country's brutal civil war. In India, lawmaker and opposition leader Rahul Gandhi has been disqualified from parliament and sentenced to 2 years in prison after he was convicted for criticizing Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Gandhi was found guilty of defamation for saying at a 2019 campaign rally, quote, "Why do all thieves have Modi as their surname?" Gandhi was expected to run against Modi in 2024. Back in the United States on Capitol Hill, TikTok CEO Shouzi Chu was grilled by House lawmakers for over 5 hours on the app's ties to the Chinese government, data practices and effects on children's mental health. This is Democratic Florida Congressmember Darren Soto questioning Chu.
So, Mr. Chu, would TikTok be prepared to divest from ByteDance and Chinese Communist Party ties if the Department of Treasury instructed you all to do so?
Congressman, I said in my opening statement, I think we need to address the problem of privacy. I agree with you. I don't think ownership is the issue here. With a lot of respect, American social companies don't have a good track record with data privacy and user security. I mean, look at Facebook and Cambridge Analytica.
This comes as a number of progressive lawmakers are speaking out against what they see as politically motivated attempts to ban or scapegoat TikTok, saying it's driven by dangerous anti-Chinese sentiment. This is New York Democrat Jamal Bowman speaking at a rally earlier this week.
We can keep TikTok, we can protect freedom of speech, and we could deal with the privacy concerns at the same time. We could do both. And right now, we're not trying to do both.
Meanwhile, in Utah, Republican Governor Spencer Cox signed sweeping social media legislation Thursday that requires anyone 18 or younger to get explicit parental consent to use apps such as Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok, though it's unclear how this will be enforced. Critics warn the law could cause more harm to marginalized teens and children for whom social media can be a lifeline, including LGBTQ minors who access vital support and information online. Georgia and Iowa have become the latest states to enact anti-trans laws. On Thursday, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp signed a bill banning gender-affirming surgeries and hormone replacement therapies for transgender youth under the age of 18. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds signed a similar bill Wednesday, along with another measure banning trans students from entering school bathrooms or changing rooms that match their gender identities. This comes as World Athletics, the global governing body for track and field, voted Thursday to ban trans women from elite competitions if they transitioned after puberty. Advocates of the anti-trans policy claim trans women athletes have a physical advantage over cisgender women, but science refutes that. A report published in 2017 in the journal Sports Medicine finds there's, quote, no direct or consistent research, unquote, showing trans athletes have an advantage over others. A Michigan court has ordered the parents of the Oxford High School mass shooter to stand trial for manslaughter. Ethan Crumbly was just 15 years old at the time of the attack last November, which killed four students and injured six others. On Thursday, the Michigan Court of Appeals ruled there's enough evidence to bring Jennifer and James Crumbly, his parents, to trial after they gave their son easy access to a gun, failed to inform the school, and failed to stop the massacre despite clear warning signs. Meanwhile, in Colorado, the Denver Public School District voted unanimously Thursday to temporarily suspend its ban on armed guards and police officers in schools. The ban had been in place since 2021 after a wave of protests against police brutality erupted following the murder of George Floyd. This comes after two faculty members at Denver's East High School were shot and wounded Wednesday by a 17-year-old with a handgun. Police say they found the teen dead of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. The shooting came just over a month after another shooting at the same school fatally wounded 16-year-old Luis Garcia. That prompted a massive march from Denver's East High to the nearby state capitol. And in California, about 60,000 education workers have ended a three-day strike at the Los Angeles Unified School District without an agreement on a new union contract. The strike prompted Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass to join contract talks as a mediator after district officials failed to reach an agreement with the union following more than a year of negotiations. SEIU Local 99 says many of its members who work as bus drivers, custodians, and teachers' aides earn poverty wages of roughly $12 per hour in one of the most expensive cities in the United States. This is Jason Terrell-Rangel, an English teacher at Roosevelt High School and winner of the 2022 California Teacher of the Year Award.
I'm a second-generation teacher. My parents taught in LAUSD. They struck in 1989 and walked the line. I'm here proudly in my second strike with my SEIU brothers and sisters. We're demanding a living wage for them. They're not asking for $1 million. They're not asking to be millionaires. They're asked to be lifted out of poverty. And in a district that has a $4.9 billion surplus in the richest state in the nation that pays their superintendent $440,000 a year, I think we can afford it. I think we can show them that they deserve this respect for them and for our students.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in France, where unions say more than 3 million people took to the streets in a nationwide general strike Thursday to protest President Emmanuel Macron's deeply unpopular move to unilaterally raise the retirement age from 62 to 64 without giving the French parliament a chance to vote on the plan. On Monday, Macron survived a vote of no confidence by just 9 votes. In Bordeaux on Thursday, the town hall was set on fire. And in Paris, police fired tear gas at protesters, who included transportation workers, garbage collectors, teachers, students and more.
We're here today because it's out of the question to once again raise the retirement age. You have to understand that some people work in difficult conditions, and today these people are told that not only do they have to work longer, but also nothing prevents the government in the future to restart this type of bill. It's time for them to understand that people also want to enjoy their lives. We're not here to die on the job. We're here to be able to enjoy life one day, too.
As protests continue, a visit by British King Charles to France has just been postponed. Striking workers had said they'd refuse to roll out the red carpet for him. France's 8 largest unions have called another nationwide protest for this Tuesday. For more, we go to Marseille, France, to speak with the journalist Cole Stangler, whose guest essay in The New York Times today is headlined, France is furious. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Cole. Can you describe the level of mass protest and disgust in the streets right now throughout France? And talk about how this was pushed through.
Yeah, so, you know, I think there's really two things going on here, if you want to simplify it, as you were just explaining. You have, on the one hand, this pension reform that's extremely unpopular just on itself, on the merits. Polls show about anywhere from 2/3 to 7 out of 10 French people have opposed this reform from the very beginning. So going back to January, at the very first protest that we saw, they see it as unfair, hurting the least well-off in French society, disproportionately hurting manual workers, hurting women. So a lot of opposition to the reform itself going on now for 2 months. We've had this wave of mobilization, wave of strikes. And then, as you were mentioning, what has sort of energized the movement further is the way that the government has gotten this reform done, the way they've gotten it across the finish line. Last Friday, there was supposed to be a vote in the National Assembly on this unpopular bill. The government, when they realized they didn't have the votes to actually get it approved in the National Assembly, deployed this constitutional measure that allows them to approve the bill without a vote in Parliament. And so then on Monday, Macron survived this motion of no confidence. So in theory, this bill is now going to be taking effect. There's a couple of ways to perhaps block it, which we can maybe get into. But that the way the government has carried out this reform, I think, has given the movement new life. It's why unions have called for another day of mobilization on Thursday. And it's why we have another one set up next week, because people see that as really unfair. Not only is the government trying to do this pension reform that people see as fundamentally unfair, but they're ignoring historically large protests, even by French standards. They're ignoring the opinion polls. They're ignoring moderate labor unions that have said, let's negotiate something. And so all of this is fueling this movement. And right now, it feels very similar to the Yellow Vest movement back in late 2018, early 2019, where you have this government that it doesn't seem to understand the anger that it's unleashed.
So can you talk about the ways where it's possible this would be rolled back, Cole?
Yeah, so there's a precedent that a lot of people have in their minds, which is the 2006 youth employment contract. At the time, you had mass mobilization from student unions, from labor unions, to oppose this reform. The National Assembly actually passed this bill in February 2006. The movement continued, and then a couple months later, the prime minister, under the guidance of then-president Jacques Chirac, thought maybe this was not the best time to be approving this extremely polarizing, unpopular law that was creating mass protests. And so the government actually did not apply the law that had been passed, and they actually then the National Assembly passed a law repealing it. So that's one method. That's one route. And that's why we have protests that are continuing. It's why we have unions that are saying, you know, this isn't over yet, trying to give the government a sort of exit ramp if they wanted to de-escalate things. That's one route. The other route, the most significant route, would be the French Constitutional Council, the equivalent, rough equivalent of the Supreme Court, examining this law and deciding to invalidate parts or all of the bill. There's a lot of questions over that specific measure that the government has deployed, again, to get this bill across the finish line, Article 49.3 of the French Constitution. Critics say that it wasn't really meant for a reform of this nature. The government attached this massive pension reform to a very particular budget bill. And so there's a sort of technical argument to be made that this article was applied inappropriately. And, you know, the Constitutional Council will be meeting as well amid this, upheaval, amid these mass protests that, as you mentioned, are not dying out. We have another wave scheduled for next week.
And who is supporting the president in this? I mean, clearly, overwhelmingly, the population is against this.
Emmanuel Macron has a base of voters that's very real. I don't want to, you know, we shouldn't forget that. The Macronist base tends to be wealthier. They tend to be older voters. They tend to vote more as well. We saw this in the legislative elections last summer. So you have a small chunk of the French population, about a third, according to polls, that supports this reform. But they're really in the minority. And I think if you're looking forward to, if we're looking ahead to sort of who's going to benefit from this, I think it's important to stress as well that, you know, if you look at France from abroad, there's often a tendency to look at simply Emmanuel Macron, the president, and then his opposition on the far right, so represented by Marine Le Pen. It should be stressed that Le Pen and the National Rally have played effectively no role in this protest movement. The movement is led by labor unions, going from moderate labor unions to more militant left-wing labor unions, and it's being led by the parties of the left. I think it's an important point to stress here. People that sort of expected or thought that maybe the French left was dead or that labor unions in France couldn't mobilize anymore have been proven wrong by this movement. You have a mass movement that's being led by labor that has shown it continues to have the sort of cultural appeal, the sort of power to mobilize the French workforce.
Well, Cole Stengler, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Paris-based journalist speaking to us, though, from Marseille. Coming up, Congressmember Ro Khanna on the banking crisis, on the attempts from Republicans to Democrats to ban TikTok and more. Stay with us. We'll be right back. He's picturesque, number 9, Menuet Pampo, the Orchestra Nacional de Lyon, and Leonard Slatkin this week. Concertgoers threw coins and booed musicians of the orchestra as the musicians read out a union statement about President Macron's plans to postpone the pension age in France by 2 more years. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're joined now by the Democratic Congressmember Ro Khanna of Silicon Valley of California, to talk about the banking crisis, the attempts to ban TikTok, East Palestine, and more. Congressmember Khanna recently joined Senator Elizabeth Warren, Congressmember Katie Porter, and others to push for stronger banking regulations following the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. Khanna has criticized fellow Democrats who supported a 2018 bill that weakened Dodd-Frank, the landmark regulatory reform passed in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. Executives from Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank were among those who successfully lobbied to weaken rules that may have prevented their collapse. Silicon Valley Bank is based in Ro Khanna's district in California. Congressmember Khanna, welcome back to Democracy Now! What needs to happen, not only with SVB and Signature, but overall? How can the regulations be tightened?
Well, thanks for having me back. We need to regulate large regional banks the same way that we regulate the big four banks. I remember when the Silicon Valley Bank executives were in my office in 2018 pushing for deregulation. I voted against that deregulation. I believe that the deregulation was a cause of the bank failure. You would have had liquidity tests. You would have had stress tests. Now, I know Secretary Yellen has said maybe those tests would not have captured the liquidity challenges with the rapid rise in interest rates. First of all, that's a problem with the tests if they're not capturing that. But regardless of whether the tests would have captured that, it would have sent a signal to the regulators to pay more attention to what was going on in Silicon Valley Bank, and that would have prevented the gross mismanagement. Instead, what we said is, if you're one of these regional banks like Silicon Valley Bank, you have carte blanche to do whatever you want without much regulatory oversight. It was a colossal mistake. We need to have those regulations back.
On Monday, ABC News reported the Fed was aware of Silicon Valley Bank's problems, and they warned them. But what do warnings mean? Where are the concrete regulations, and what is your critique of the Federal Reserve and Jerome Powell?
Well, the critique of Jerome Powell, with due respect, is that he missed the inflation early on, and then he's gone from 0 to 60 with very rapid interest rate hikes that has created some of this challenge. Now, I don't want to exonerate or excuse the bank management. They were greedy. They were in long-term bonds for a slightly higher interest rate with no hedge on it, and they had large, wealthy depositors with no diversification. So the first blame is with the bank executives, but the Fed's rapid increase of interest rates contributed. And the fact that the Fed had this warning without enforcement was a problem, but that's because of the weakening of the Dodd-Frank regulations. Ultimately, in my view, it's the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, that's supposed to be regulating these banks, and they would have much more authority if they had Dodd-Frank-type regulations.
So you have the San Francisco-based bank First Republic in big crisis right now, being relegated to junk. And so you have a lot of people who are saying, well, we've got to just invest in the largest banks, calling them the most stable. At the same time, you have a massive climate protest this week across the country where people are cutting up their credit cards to these banks because of their fossil fuel promotion. So, just asking, you are talking about shoring up community banks. How do you do that now? And how do you tell people that where they're banking, if it's outside the big ones of Citibank and Chase and Bank of America, are safe?
Amy, we need to protect community banks, and you're absolutely right. Otherwise, all of the money is going to go into the big four banks, and that's going to be bad for regional economic development or for some of the causes that you're talking about if the power is all consolidated with the big four banks. The first point is, in the last 10 years of the 73 bank failures, in almost all of them, I think in 72 or 73 of them, the depositors have been guaranteed. So in our recent history, depositors are guaranteed. What I have said is that we should say that depositors in this country will be guaranteed, at least for the next year or two. And how are we going to pay for that? We're going to pay for that with a bank fee, a bank premium, and require accounts over $250,000 to have a mandatory fee to be able to pay for that insurance. Right now, it's basically like you've got these wealthy account holders. People have $1 million, $2 million. I analogize them to uninsured drivers. They're out there. They don't have any insurance. If they cause harm, it's the taxpayer that ends up doing the deposit guarantee. We ought to have a mandatory fee over $250,000 and then be able to guarantee those depositors.
So as we talk about the horrors of capitalism right now, I wanted to go to your vote on the horrors of socialism, so-called. In early February, Republicans in Congress had a vote to denounce the horrors of socialism, specifically referring to it in that way. Congressmember Khanna, you were the national co-chair of a socialist candidate for president, right, of Bernie Sanders. And yet, unlike AOC, unlike even Steny Hoyer, unlike Rashida Tlaib, you actually voted to support this, to surprise of many?
Well, it's a fair question. I have always called myself an FDR Democrat. I have tried to make the case that Medicare for All, free public college, universal child care, a livable wage are policies that are not just, but are that are going to lead to economic growth, that are going to lead to entrepreneurship, that are going to lead to innovation. Every time we talk about childcare at $10 a day, the Republicans say, well, what about Stalin? What about Lenin? What about Pol Pot? And that is a rhetorical tactic that doesn't solve people's problems. What I have tried to do is frame progressive principles as consistent with the free enterprise system of the United States, as Hamilton, as FDR did. And that's why I voted that way. But I understand that people also voted a different way, and I respect that vote.
I want to turn to TikTok. On Thursday, the TikTok CEO, Shouzi Chu, was grilled by House lawmakers for over 5 hours on the app's ties to the Chinese government, data practices, its effects on children's mental health. The hearing took place just days after the Biden administration demanded that the Chinese-owned TikTok be sold or else face a national ban in the United States. During his opening statement, the TikTok CEO, Chu, vowed to protect user data of American users. This is what he said.
We have heard important concerns about the potential for unwanted foreign access to U.S. data and potential manipulation of the TikTok U.S. ecosystem. Our approach has never been to dismiss or trivialize any of these concerns. We have addressed them with real action. Now, that's what we've been doing for the last 2 years, building what amounts to a firewall that seals off protected U.S. user data from unauthorized foreign access. The bottom line is this: American data stored on American soil by an American company overseen by American personnel. We call this initiative Project Texas. That's where Oracle is headquartered. Today, U.S. TikTok data is stored by default in Oracle servers. Only vetted personnel operating in a new company called TikTok US Data Security can control access to this data.
So that's the TikTok CEO. Word is that the House Speaker and Democrats and Republicans are going to put forward a vote to ban TikTok unless it's sold to I don't know if it's just an American or a non-Chinese corporation. Democratic Congressmember Jamal Bowman of New York wasn't in that hearing yesterday, but he's been one of the sole lawmakers to defend TikTok. This is what he says.
So we're talking about free speech for everyday Americans. We're talking about small business owners who use TikTok to grow their business. And my question is, and we're going to pivot to the other part of the conversation, why the hysteria and the panic and the targeting of TikTok?